Please the court. My name is David Hargett, and I represent Mr. Gibbs on the appeal of his conviction out of Chesterfield for felony neglect. The only issue here is the sufficiency of the evidence to establish basically that Mr. Gibbs had the requisite knowledge and requisite intent when he left his child in his apartment for approximately 40 minutes or so. This is a very, very, as this court is aware, it's a very, very short record. I think the testimony spans maybe a total of 40 pages. So there is very, very limited evidence here. And the only thing that you really have is that the parent probably made a bad choice. But that's not really the standard.
It's not the first time, though, is it? Because don't we have to consider the fact that a month before, when he left this 5-year-old with his teenage brother, the same thing happened. And he got loose and he headed out toward that pool and the pond in the apartment complex and those streets with a lot of traffic. So it's not like he didn't know, and he's 5 and he's been suspended from school as a kindergartner already multiple times, at least twice. So given the father's knowledge of his impulsiveness and his behavior, Why don't we look at the totality of the circumstances and say a rational fact finder could come to this conclusion?
Well, first I would have to disagree that it's this exact same thing happened prior. We don't know anything other than the mere statement that a month prior he went down to the pool while his brother was supposed to be watching him. I mean, we don't really know what the circumstances were. We don't know if the doors were wide open. We don't know anything about that incident other than those few, let's call them, facts. So that, to put somebody on notice, that it is then a reasonable person would conclude that it's likely that the child would be injured is a bit of a stretch. And there's no real facts from which you can infer, even under the totality of the circumstances. Plus, I mean, we're talking about the pool. Pool is a danger. Sure, I understand that. It's a gated pool. It's locked. It's closed off. There's no evidence that he was at the pool or in the pool or near the pool.
I mean, he was found across several streets at a Costco parking lot, wasn't he?
Well, but we're talking about what a reasonable person would believe would likely happen or would likely to be injured. So the pond. And the only evidence that we have in this case is the pond is just like the pool. It's gated. It's locked.
The word that we always have to look to in this statute is the word willful.
Right.
I think both A and B require willful neglect. And we've defined, the Supreme Court has defined willful as knowing that injury is likely to occur, will occur. Is there any evidence in this case to show that death or injury was likely to occur?
There totally isn't. I mean, there's absolutely nothing to believe that. And that's why the only thing that you have that would put them on notice about the likelihood of injury was this one prior incident. That's it. That's all you have.
Well, he was aware that the child could get out of the apartment. I mean, that's what we can infer from that prior incident. But neither that incident nor this resulted in any injury.
Right. And as a matter of fact, the previous time had nothing to do with walking down the street. And there was no reason to believe that he would wander any further away than the apartment complex, if at all. And we also know that when Mr. Gibbs left the apartment was completely secure. It was a safe environment. It's not like there was anything that was inherently dangerous with regard to that. And the facts of the case are much more akin to the lady who left her children in the car in the parking lot unattended for 14 or 15 minutes. And we have several decisions from this court over the past, I think, 12 months or so that really addresses this issue. And, you know, there...
What about the Barnes case from this court, for example, where the lady left 2 children, and they were actually asleep in her apartment or home, and she drove to the grocery store and got groceries, but she absented herself from the property, unlike in Ellis, where she went to a neighbor's house and was not that far away, or the lady in the parking lot...
you know, whose children were in the parking lot. So, and you have the Supreme Court in Carosi saying the mens rea in the statute involved in Barnes and in this statute are essentially the same mens rea. So why wouldn't Barnes, it's a very similar situation, about the same amount of time, where the parent absented himself or herself from the whole area?
You know, Barnes is an interesting case because it's a 2006 case that really wasn't the focus of this court's decisions in the Hunan case or the Ashley White case of recent time.
But and White was under subpart A of the statute. This is under B1 of the statute.
Right, right. I mean, you still have to have the intent, the requisite knowledge,
but
not
the injury.
Totally not the injury, of course, if understandable.
What do we make of the fact that Barnes was decided November 29th, 2005, and that in November 2006, the Supreme Court came out with its Morris v. Commonwealth opinion, which is pretty much contradicts Barnes. Is Barnes good law?
I don't think that Barnes is good law if you're going to rely on it. Whether that means that Barnes was specifically overturned, I think that's a bit of a stretch, because, of course, this is a very fact-intense
issue. I mean, the facts in Morris are pretty similar to the facts we have here today.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think that's why the Barnes decision is not as significant, and that's why I would think that this court did not rely upon Barnes in the more recent decisions involving this type of behavior.
Does this case require us to basically decide at what age a parent is prohibited from leaving a child without supervision? Do we have to draw a line here?
Absolutely not, because that would be arbitrary. You know, in the question of reasonable, objective person, what a reasonable parent would believe would likely cause injury would depend upon a number of factors. Now, one of them, of course, would be age. It would also be maturity. It would also be, you know, a whole host of other things. But it's not a age-specific. There is no fine line that you can draw based on age, I would say.
We seem to have a lot of these Home Alone cases.
Yes. It is a little unfortunate. But you know, the... I mean, in this day and age, you know, what happens is the cases where there's injury, I can understand those cases being prosecuted. The cases where there's no injury, you know, maybe get the Department of Social Services involved just to make sure that everything's on the up and up. But otherwise, I think that what you have is that you end up having a situation where...
The two factors here do concern me that I'd like you to address. One is the child's lack of appropriate clothing for the weather. It appeared to me that the trial court could and possibly did rely on the fact that he was lightly dressed and the temperatures were fairly chilly. And the second thing that concerns me is what inferences can the trial court draw from how busy that street was? We know there was a Costco there, but I can't find anything else in the record that shows whether this was a, you know, the backside of a Costco where there's no traffic, or whether it's the six-lane street with multiple turn lanes on it. What could the trial court rely on here?
Well, if I may take the second one first. As far as the record is concerned, we don't have anything in the record about the roadway, other than there was a roadway that had cars on it. And so it is, I think, speculation to... And there's nothing even to say that he had to cross lanes of traffic or anything like that. So that is a factor that I would say is in our favor, because here we're talking about the Commonwealth failed to prove their case. So there could have been evidence there wasn't. There was a busy roadway. As far as his clothing is concerned, I believe that it really kind of begs the question, because the child was not left outside. Child actually was in his bedroom and in a secure, safe apartment.
But the father was on notice. The child had was wondered able to get out of the house.
Had gone downstairs at one point while he was with his brother, with no other facts to indicate what that entailed. Were they fighting? Was there something else going on? I mean, we have no idea other than that basic information. So, I mean, even if he's wearing a t-shirt in 48-degree weather or what have you, walking downstairs to where the pool area is certainly not something that would likely result in injury. And if I've addressed the court's questions, I'll just reserve the remainder of my time.
All right. Thank you. You have your rebuttal time, Mr. Forster.
May it please the court, Stephen Forster on behalf of the Commonwealth. I would start by noting that the standard review is in light most favorable to the Commonwealth, and we're looking at the facts through that lens, and it's all inferences in favor of the Commonwealth. And when we look to the facts of this case, they're overwhelming, and that the likelihood of harm was readily apparent. Now, we're looking at the father, who lives in the apartment. He's aware that there are roadways through the complex. He's aware that there's traffic.
Mr. Forster, when I was 5 years old, my mom let me walk to kindergarten about a mile every day, up and back. Would she be guilty of, felony child neglect by not supervising me to school and back?
Well, Your Honor, I would say it's a factually dependent situation. We're looking at, you know, again, crossing roadways is noted in Barnes, which is still good law. It says, you know, the hypothetical was the children could have walked out into vehicular traffic. Here we have testimony on the record that establishes that there was traffic on these roads. The extent of the traffic, albeit unknown, however, there was traffic, and we have a 5-year-old who's unsupervised crossing a road and going to Costco.
Tell me why you think Barnes is good law in light of Morris.
Well, it hasn't been expressly overruled.
I understand that, but aren't the facts in Morris pretty similar to the facts in this case? We have two young children left unsupervised in a, I think it was an apartment area. There were dangers, engine blocks, weightlifting benches and weights on it, close to a road. Why isn't that pretty much on point with the facts we have here?
Well, I agree it's similar, but I would argue that it's distinguishable. And in this case, although the roads were close in that case, we have crossing of the apartment complex road. We have walking near a pool. We have going by a pond. He traversed or was able to get through two different fences and then cross a road that was it had traffic on it. A 5-year-old should not be crossing a road with traffic without supervision, and that's where this likelihood of
harm. Well, isn't the parent the one to decide whether the child is mature enough to cross a road?
I agree that, as was noted in one of the other cases in which the driver of the vehicle, the mother, was intoxicated, the court did not condone her parenting, and perhaps we wouldn't condone that type of parenting. But in here, we're looking at a totality of the circumstances, a totality of all the different harms that were present with the child, and what the father's knowledge of those harms was.
Can I ask you about Morris? Because I may be misremembering, but I thought in Morris, the mother was still at the home. She was just asleep taking a nap. Is that wrong? Or here you have the father who intentionally absented himself from the premises, drove to a school for a pre-scheduled meeting, and didn't take the child with him. Said he couldn't take the child with him because the child had been suspended. But he left him alone, as in Barnes, where the lady left the children alone to go to the grocery store, unlike in Ellis, where she just went next door to or a few doors down to a neighbor. I thought in Morris the mother was still around.
You know, I would agree with Your Honor. The line of cases that have come out specifically, you know, they are distinguished based on those grounds.
Why does that make a difference? Is the parent more able to prevent the unsupervised child from getting hurt if she's asleep in the apartment as opposed to meeting with the child's principal? What's the difference?
I would agree, Your Honor. The difference is when a parent is home, they are capable of being immediately there for the child. The child
is
outside.
They're asleep.
They are still able to be there for the child. The difference is here we have an absent parent that regardless of whether he's called or contacted, he cannot provide help at that point. He's driven away. He's not there. And in the line of case, again, we talk about Barnes being good law. You know, the parent was away for an hour.
So we should draw the line, we should make a distinction between the parent who is incapacitated in some way in the apartment and a parent who is physically absent from the apartment. Is that the bright line we should draw?
No, Your Honor, I don't think it's completely incapacitated, but when we look at the case of, I believe it's Barrett, we have someone who is completely, you know, has this knowledge component. They know that the child has this propensity for violence towards the other child and is completely incapacitated, whereas someone just sleeping, perhaps incapacitated, but still is able to help. I don't think there is a bright line to draw there, but I do think it's distinguishable, and therefore Barnes is still good law and can still control in this case because it's more similar on its facts.
Let me ask you this question. The General Assembly has recognized the fundamental right of a parent to be a parent. Code Section 1-240.1 provides that a parent has a fundamental right to make decisions concerning the upbringing, education, and care of the parent's child. Doesn't that mean that the General Assembly recognizes that it's the parent who should decide whether a child is mature enough to be left home alone?
Well, certainly under the statute, the parent is able to make that decision. However, going back to the totality of these circumstances, then we have to look to the knowledge and intent component of this, which is we have a child who's been repeatedly suspended from school. He's impulsive. We have a prior situation in which he was able to leave the home with his brother there and roam around the apartment complex where there are streets, there's traffic, he's getting out. There's a knowledge component which goes to the reasonableness and of what the father did in this case. And it goes to that question of whether or not he had knowledge that the particular conduct would likely result in harm or death. And in this case, when we look at all of those factors together, we can come to that conclusion, again, in light most favorable of the Commonwealth and all reasonable inferences in favor of the Commonwealth, that that is the case here. Again, when we look to, going back to Ellis, we see a parent that goes down the street is not absented from being able to help their child. And I believe it was noted as well in Barnes, it says, leaving young children for long periods of time creates an untenable situation in which children likely will suffer harm. And here, I would say that the minimum amount of time that the defendant was gone was 53 minutes. And that's so we're looking at an hour, which makes it very close to Barnes in terms of the proximity of time. And again, when we look at the, I believe it's Hanan, which was 15 minutes, that was insufficient. But here, we're looking at the harms that were likely to occur. Father is aware of all of the dangers that surround the apartment complex. He has prior knowledge of his son's desire and propensity to leave the apartment and to go out into these dangerous zones. We then have evidence on the record that he left the apartment, he crosses a road where there's traffic in the apartment complex, he goes through passes by several dangerous, a pond and a pool, he goes through a few fences, and then he's crossing another road on his way to Costco. He doesn't know where his father is, he's going to the hospital, but his father's not there. And again, we're looking at these Barnes factors, those are all components. We also look at the age and maturity of the child. While some 5-year-olds may be very mature and capable of staying home, in this particular case, on the facts, this child was not. This child had a propensity to, he was impulsive. That's why he was being suspended. When we look at all of these circumstances, we get to that knowledge component, that the father was aware of the likelihood of this result.
I want to take you back to questions I had a few moments ago about your distinguishing these cases based on whether the parent is home or is somewhere else outside the home, sleeping versus a case like this. Wasn't Ellis a case where the mother was physically absent from the house? She had gone over to a neighbor's house?
I would agree that the mother was absent from the physical home, but was still in close enough proximity to be readily available for the children if need be.
How can you draw that from the facts of Ellis? I'm not sure the facts of Ellis are...
Well, in Ellis,
that's specific.
I apologize, Your Honor. In Ellis, the testimony was it was approximately 50 yards away. So we're looking at 150 feet in that case. So when we look at Ellis, we're looking at 150 feet. Here, we're talking about someone who physically drove a vehicle minutes down the road. Again, the exact distance is unknown, but there's an absenting from the entire apartment complex. He leaves the apartment. And the other component is he left the apartment unlocked. And we have other case law that talks about where the mother locked the door, her roommate comes home, and then the roommate leaves the door unlocked, and the children get out. Well, no, that's not. You can't.
Does the record show that it was left unlocked?
I know that there was an indication the screen had a slash in it. So,
I would argue to the court that the reasonable inference is that the door was unlocked. We do not have anything definitively on the record where he testified, I left it unlocked. But the inference is that the door was unlocked and he was capable of getting out. And again, we look at that component as well in light of the other case law, and we're left with all of these facts, all of these dangers that were knowledgeable. And to say that the child had to go out and get hurt in the prior instance, and I believe it was January, would create a whole new rule.
Is that a difference then in your argument between subpart A, a conviction under subpart A, like we had in White, which we reversed, and B1 here and in some of these other cases where an injury is not required?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, we're looking at this through the lens that we don't have to have an injury, and we're looking at the likelihood of that injury.
But White turned on the question of willful, which is required in both subsection A and subsection B prosecution. So the reasoning of White is equally applicable to this case. And I believe in White, we basically said that to accept the Commonwealth's proposition would require a parent to virtually sanitize the environment of the child to make sure that there were no swimming pools, ponds, septic tanks, trees to climb, jungle gyms to go up. I mean, you have to wrap the child in a bubble.
Well, I would argue that, again, in White, the court went through and defined willful without justifiable excuse and acknowledged that the particular conduct will likely result in harm. And in that case, it's very well written.
we'll see how it's good law in the next 6 months or so.
But in that case, the court went through and said, the mother was home in the house sleeping, but that the child was playing video games, and that the mother had no knowledge that the four bolts were missing from the lid of the septic tank. She had no knowledge that the lid was loose. She had no knowledge that the child had previously, gone or was playing around with the lid on the septic tank. There was that knowledge component really seemed to be missing in that case, whereas here the knowledge component is readily apparent, and I've argued they're distinguishable.
In White, and I don't know it as well as my good colleague Avery here, but in White, I was recalling there were also two convictions under B1 that were not appealed, which I think were when mother left the two children and drove father to work and left them home asleep.
I agree, Your Honor. Yes, that is the case. Those are the facts of White. And again, that's another component of why it's distinguishable here. And again,
whether that trial court was right or wrong, all we know is he was last.
That's very true, Your Honor. Again,
I want to ask you about one other. You mentioned earlier a case, and I apologize, the name escapes me right now. The case where the woman left her child in a car at a store, and this is not the Dollar General case.
The case I was referring to, Your Honor, is Hanan versus Commonwealth, 68 VA App 87, 2017.
Is that the case where it was, I believe, she left the child in the car for half an hour, 45 minutes?
It was 15 minutes, Your Honor. It was 15 minutes in that
That's
case.
That's a Dollar General case.
Yes,
okay,
that is a Dollar General case, Your Honor.
I know we had two leaving the child in the car while they were shopping cases.
Yes, and the other case in which you're referring to is the mother left the children at home in the apartment. She drove to the shopping center, was gone for approximately an hour.
No, that's okay.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
That's all right.
That's the Barnes case.
Yes, that's the Barnes case. But and again, I've answered all the court's questions. I would simply conclude by saying this is a case, it's light most favorable of the Commonwealth. We have a prior incident in which the father was aware that the child had a propensity to leave the apartment and engage in dangerous conduct. On a particular day in question, the child was left at home alone in an unlocked apartment. He left his bedroom. He left the apartment. He was underdressed, didn't have the appropriate clothing for the weather. He crossed an apartment road, pool, a pond, went through two fences. He then crossed another road that was congested with traffic, and the father had full knowledge of all of those dangers that were surrounding the apartment at the time he made the choice to leave the child home alone for approximately 1 hour. And because he absented himself from there, the Commonwealth would ask that the court affirm. If there are no further questions, I'll return my time to the court.
Thank you, Mr. Forster. Mr. Hargett, you have your rebuttal time.
Thank you. I would like to clarify, as far as the record is concerned, there is no evidence that the apartment was unlocked. As a matter of fact, that's the scary kind of inference that the other side wants to have you draw when there is nothing to make that inference. There's no inference to suggest that it was locked or if it wasn't locked. So you have a situation where really where the reasonable hypothesis of innocence kind of controls in analyzing that particular fact, because you don't know. You'd have to speculate to say that it was unlocked.
If it's locked, it keeps someone outside from getting in to harm the child. So
correct.
That's good. But most five-year-olds can unlock the door.
Right. But if you were going to emphasize whether it was locked or unlocked, it's wrong to say that it was unlocked.
I hear you.
And as far as Ellis is concerned, and Morris as well, and I think Judge Petty, you're exactly right. It doesn't necessarily matter if you're present or not. If you recall in Ellis, what's significant is there, even though that she wasn't that far away, she wasn't within eyesight, if I recall the facts correctly, of her apartment.
Not eyesight, but supposedly yelling distance, right?
Right, but she didn't know that the place was on fire until she heard sirens. So if you don't know the place is on fire until you hear sirens...
There was a question of intent that she didn't realize she'd left the stove on. Right?
Correct.
Wasn't that a big issue in that case?
Correct. Yes. She accidentally... I believe she lit a cigarette and then didn't turn the gas off or the burner off, and that's what caused it.
Doesn't that case really point out the fact that there's many dangers inside the home as there are outside the home?
Exactly.
So that if you don't keep your five-year-old constantly monitored and they get into the knife drawer or climb up on the kitchen counter and fall off, whatever, you could be held responsible.
I agree. There are literally unlimited number of dangers
within. Those of us who raise five-year-olds know that they're sometimes capable of finding dangers that no adult could ever consider.
Exactly. And the same thing that happened in Morris. In Morris, the children were out in the woods somewhere. I mean, there are literally any number of things that could have happened to them while she was napping, but she's clearly not in a position where she could assist them if they were in danger. So I think that given all those factors...
isn't that a distinction? Because all of us sleep at some point. I mean, the kid could wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning and decide to go somewhere. But if we're in the house asleep, or you're taking a mother who's worn out from looking after children all day, takes a nap, isn't it different actually leaving the premises and going somewhere else, knowing your child has gotten out before? You're not home. You're not able to be awakened. If you need it to be, called if you're having coffee with your neighbor two doors down.
Well, I think in the facts in Morris, it was just a matter of a couple of days prior that the kids left the home and were unattended. So, I mean,
been on notice not to take a nap, I guess, is what you're saying.
Well, exactly. I mean, essentially, yes. It's unfortunate, but, the Barrett case was mentioned, and that involves sleeping while something bad happened inside the home. And so, actually, I was counsel of record in that case, and that was one of the cases where we said that the definition of willful means bad intent, bad purpose. And you have to have bad intent and bad purpose here in order for it to be willfully engaging in child neglect, not just mere negligence or gross negligence, but criminal negligence. And I would argue that the facts here do not support criminal negligence.
Thank you, Mr. Hargett. We will recounsel, and then the next cases on the docket.